Graduated, I may have done a junior at high school.
Like what year would this have been?
I graduated from high school in 31, so it could have been 1930 that I worked for him, or it could have been the summer of 31.
Either while you were still in high school or right at the end of your high school?
Yeah, I had not gotten to college.
That summer?
Yeah.
And Arthur Raper at that time was working in Greene County, Alabama, in Greene County, Georgia a lot, wasn't he?
Well, he was. And the reason he was because of the fact he had written his dissertation at Chapel Hill on the stuff that later came out as Preface to Peasantry.
Yeah.
And they'd gotten a little grant for him to bring it up to date. The data was out of date by the time they got the grant.
Right.
And he was working at the Commission on Interracial Cooperation as field secretary of some such type. And about that time, he started teaching at Agnes Scott. And he influenced a generation of Agnes Scott women, people like Liza Pasco, who later played a prominent part in political and social, political and organizational life in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Betty Vinson, mm-hmm. Ed Vinson's wife in Washington. And so all he needed was some flunky to help him that summer, because he was working on bringing this data up to date. So I went with him to Greene County.
Which is where?
It's due east of here toward Augusta, about 60 or 70 miles.
Over there south of Athens?
A little bit east of Athens.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's a little bit, I guess it's a little bit northeast of Athens.
Uh-huh.
And what he was measuring in Greene County was the preface to peasantry for that was the coming of the agricultural depressions in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of farmers had mortgages on their farms. The mortgages were held by insurance companies. And so the peasantry was the fact that the insurance companies had taken over just thousands of acres of land, thousands of farms. And that was one of the things he was writing about in the book's up there on the shelf.
Yeah.
And what he wanted to do was to check up on and bring some of that data up to date. And I can't remember exactly what we did, but when we were in Greene County, we spent a lot of time in the county records, tax offices, and places like that to see that this so-and-so plot out here, 275 acres, is owned by the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company or by some other insurance company, and making notes on all of this. And we stayed in a boarding house there in Greenville, and a woman that ran that bowling house couldn't figure out what we were doing. We'd go off every morning with our briefcase and come home at night. And when she told us the whole life history, trying to get us to reciprocate. Finally, one morning, she couldn't stand it longer, and she said, "Just what do you boys do?" And I piped up right there, "Oh, we're sociologists." She said, "You wouldn't josh an old lady, would you?" Another time she said to Raper, "Would you have coffee?" He said, "No, I'm stupid enough without adding to it." She came to me, "Would you have coffee?" And I said, "No, thank you." And I didn't drink coffee for years after that exchange. Well, that doesn't help any to the questions you want to ask.
Well, what kind of man was he? Did you know him then pretty much through the remainder of the 30s and early 40s?
Yeah, I didn't see much. I obviously saw more of him during that summer than I ever saw of him in a straight line of time again. But he was the first man that I had ever been around that had black friends who were friends, just as if they were this no color line at all. That was amazing to me, but I had, you know, been brought up in the traditional pattern, although my father was a good deal less given to it than a lot of people.
Still in all, it permeated the culture, and if you didn't behave that way, it was noticeable.
Yeah, yeah. And he got to see him at Atlanta University where he was teaching, Morehouse, I believe.
He taught out there for a while?
Yeah. No, this man did.
Oh, I see.
And Rayford, he was working on some things together. And Rayford was a very good worker at that, gathering that kind of data. Mm-hmm. And I've got around here somewhere a book he wrote that he sent me, a mimeographed copy of it, never was printed, of his going back to Greene County and living 1 year mm-hmm. after I knew him. And then he had a house out in Decatur. And I visited him out there a few times. They had four or five children. And his wife was the wife of a Methodist minister. And he had been the pastor of our church, as I recall it. And so she had some church connection to the old Druid Hills Methodist Church. And so Martha was her name, and she was a very nice woman. And, you know, she was fitted in perfectly with his ideological position without any problem at all. Yeah.
I may be mistaken about this, but I have acquired the impression that a number of people from that period of time had completely worked out the whole personal relationship with Black. And operated in a circle of friends that included blacks and whites, and had friends on a totally equal basis. Excuse me.
I'd say he's a perfect example of that.
I mean, even though in outward ways they could not be outspoken anti-segregationists.
Yeah.
They could live their lives that way.
And he did.
And he did.
And he taught his pupils that way. Matter of fact, he took a group of Agnes Scott girls on a field trip, I believe, to Augusta to visit Payne College. And I think there was some outrage among some of the parents because he had done that. The funniest story about him, have I told you about his name?
Yeah, about him changing his...
Change his name, yeah.
Yeah. How exactly did that work? I forgot.
Well, the way Betty Vincent told me this was, and I didn't know it till she was here last year for her 50th anniversary, and we were talking about him, and she told the story, and I never had heard it before, that after he came to Agnes Scott, or just before he came to Agnes Scott, he was approached by some officer of the university and said, Dr. Rayford, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but we don't see how we could have a professor here at Agnes Scott whose name is A. Frank Rayford. I wonder if you could do something to change that around, I guess he said to him. And so Arthur Rayford changed it from, he'd used A. Frank Rayford all his life, apparently. He changed it to Arthur F. Rayford. And that satisfied him. See, he'd written A Tragedy of Lynching by A. Frank Rayford. I can't remember that. I say that. Maybe he changed it.
He may have changed it before that.
Before that book came out.
Yeah.
So he gathered the data, and he wrote apparently a very large dissertation under Howard Odom at Chapel Hill. And I never did know much about it, but I think he grew up in a rural county of North Carolina, and I believe that Sullivan is writing, you know, the one we're talking about.
Patricia Sullivan.
I believe she's writing about that family to some extent, and about how amazingly creative all the siblings were. I've heard
she's
it from somewhere.
She's got several people in her book, including a guy named Baldwin from Virginia who worked for Farm Security.
Yeah.
And Clark Foreman.
Clark Foreman's brother was here in Atlanta, and I knew him well, named Trot Foreman.
Mm-hmm.
At Clark Forman, there was a storm in a early meeting of the Southern Regional Council around Clark Forman's position that the council ought to take a position.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, I think this is the way I remember it, on going ahead with desegregation, the council had not taken that position and didn't until Lillian Smith had quit and had an exchange of correspondence, which is in print somewhere, with Johnson,
yeah,
who was the executive of it.
Right.
And then the person that really forced the hand was Al Dent from New
Albert
Orleans.
Dent.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Who was
Dillard.
And there was some sort of a rumor that he was actually sired by Dillard, I think. Sired by a white person. I don't know. Yeah. I've heard that rumor.
Did you know Will Alexander at all?
Yes, Will Alexander was the head of the Commission on Interracial Cooperation,
right,
that summer when I was working there.
Yeah.
But he was gone an awful lot because this all of a sudden changes my dates, because he was working for the New Deal.
Well, he went up there in about 35, I think.
Well, see, that would be way past the time I've dated myself as working there.
Working at the
council, because
yeah.
He was with Agricultural Adjustment Administration, I think.
No, he was with Farm Security.
Farm Security.
Mm-hmm.
And
about 35.
I have his biography here.
Yeah.
Called Seeds of Change.
Yeah, Seeds of Southern Change.
And I could look up and see. So that changes my dates completely, because that was my understanding, that he was gone because he was mixed up with that. At least
it was
that's
during that time that he was gone that you worked with Arthur Raper?
Yeah.
So that would have been a little later on than you had it.
Than I had it, yeah.
Yeah.
Must have been while I was already at Emory.
Well, in any case, the exact date's really not that important.
Yeah. And then there was a wonderful...
I think you might need to get that, because Ann must not be hearing it. No.
Organizing Southern Women.
That was Jesse Daniel Ames.
Jesse Daniel Ames.
Yeah.
And she was sort of a foreboding, at least to me, person, sat in her office there, and I didn't get to know her very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time up there that summer drawing, filling in on Georgia maps by counties, the percentage black and the percentage.
And that was while Alexander was away working for the government.
And that was, that's
call.
The way I, as I say, I've told two yeah. different stories. And I'm not quite sure which one is right, but maybe it's a way of working on
what
something
What do you remember
else.
About Alexander as personally? Anything?
Not
about?
Much. Just the big boss who came in yeah. occasionally. And I didn't really get to know him, but I did know his son.
Mm-hmm.
They lived over here on Clifton Road. And his son and I were friends somewhere along the line mm-hmm. during those years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whatever became of that man. I hadn't mm-hmm. thought of him in years.
Yeah.
So I'm really not very helpful about the whole enterprise.
Yeah.
Except Raper later was in one of the federal programs. I guess it was a Marshall Plan. And he had charge of the Mediterranean region.
Well, he left the South in that period during the war.
Yeah.
And didn't come back for 20 years or so.
Right. I'll tell you two things he did. He was in charge of the whole Mediterranean area, and he asked me, I had lunch with him, was it, in Washington? Or he called me or something and wanted to know if I would take over Saudi Arabia. God, I looked at the map, and the place where I would have my headquarters was 600 miles from Baghdad, which was the nearest pediatrician. We had three or four children at that time. Well,
that was in the 40s.
That would have had to have been, but
late
we had
40s.
Three children, because the children were born in 47, 49, 51, and 53. So
it was even up into the 50s.
Yeah, and that was about the time of the Marshall Plan,
mm-hmm.
around the beginning of the 50s, maybe.
Well,
and another time, I saw him, I had lunch with him when I was in Washington. And the other thing he did, he was in on the on the American team at the time of the Japanese surrender. And he was there to be an advisor to General, what's his name?
MacArthur.
MacArthur, to the team that was handling the Japanese situation. He was to be an advisor on rural development, or rural redevelopment because of war damage or whatever. And
this is Raper.
Raper, yeah. And Raper told me about the fact that he, before he left there, he was to have a 15-minute interview with MacArthur. Mm-hmm. And it turned out MacArthur, and he talked, as I recall it, 2 or 3 hours. It was supposed to have been one of just sort of a formality of an apartment. Mm-hmm. And he apparently had something important to do, and I don't know any way to document this, on the shaping of the policy in regard to rural Japan after the war.
Well, do you have any notion why he chose to leave the South in the late 30s or early 40s during the war, whenever it was, and stay gone all that long?
I have no idea at all. Never thought about it, to tell you the truth.
Because it seemed curious to me, having invested as much of his time and energy and expertise as he had in the South, that he would leave just at the time when it was seemingly on the threshold of making some big social change.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it may be because he went with the Agricultural Adjustment Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not that, but with the Department
some
of Agriculture,
kind of,
I should say.
Assignment, yeah.
And I don't know why. I don't know whether he left Agnes Scott under any kind of pressure or not. But he was there at Agnes Scott for, how many years? But it must have been, my guess is, 12 or 11 dozen years.
Yeah.
And he taught a generation of Agnes Scott women who would be there 52 years ago right now. Mm-hmm. Betty Benson was here last year, 51 years ago right now,
mm-hmm.
whenever that would be.
Let me shift subjects and ask you about the Rosenwald Fund. You were one of the last Rosenwald fellows in about 1938 or 9 or 40.
I was awarded one, I think, in 47.
Okay, 47, not 37. I was thinking a whole generation, decade back. It was like 47 after the war was over.
Yeah.
You were at Wisconsin working on your doctorate.
Well, I was at Emory at the time. I had been at Wisconsin for 2 years, 39, 40, 40, 41, and had come back to Georgia Tech where I taught during the war, and went to Emory right at close to the end of the war. Went to Emory in November of 1944, so I had applied actually from an Emory address. But I had already applied a couple of times before and had not got one. And the reason I wanted to go there was because I was excited, as other people were, about this dynamic change that was happening in the South. And I wanted to go there and study under the heroes of those of us who were concerned with this, which was the cluster of people around the great sociologists.
Name some of them, like...
Well, Rupert Vance, incidentally, I made a note to tell you, and I found it on my desk the other day, that his widow is still in life.
Yeah.
And Guy Johnson, of course, was one of the lesser lights, but one of the lights.
And Odom.
Odom was the leader of that. That was sort of the generating point of excitement about studying the South and its problems. And I wanted to work in that field.
Chapel Hill stood out head and shoulders above all the other universities.
Everybody. That was the place you wanted to go if you were concerned with working in that area. And I was turned down, and so I'd taken an assistantship at Madison in 1939, which Ray Nixon was able to parlay for me out of the fact that I'd had an MA degree under him in journalism because I'd worked on the paper. And I had decided teaching English at Georgia Tech that getting a doctorate in English was not for me. I wasn't going to be enough of a scholar to learn Beowulf mm-hmm. and Middle yeah. English or something like that. And so I went out to Emory and picked up a master's degree by going in two summers and some courses in between. So Ray Nixon, who was my mentor in that, had gotten his master's degree at Wisconsin, and so he knew people up there, and he wrote to, who was the dean of the school, and got me an appointment. That's why I went mm-hmm. there instead of to Chapel Hill. But when I went there, I worked out a similar program to the one I would have had at Chapel Hill,
uh-huh.
in land economics, rural sociology,
mm-hmm.
social theory, and double minor in journalism.
And it was, you got the fellowship while you were up there?
No, I got it. See, I came back to Atlanta after 2 years there. My mother was dying of cancer, and I was the only child, and my father wanted to turn over a lot of the care to me, and I was the second of those 2 years was badly interrupted by journeys back to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had the thought if I came back to my job at Tech, I might be deferred from military service. And that's something to be proud of, I guess. And I came back in summer of 41 and did teach at Tech for most of the war and volunteered for, they came to Tech looking for instructors and people, the Navy did, and I volunteered for this program and got turned down in the examination process because my eyes didn't pass the test. So I went to an eye doctor for a year mm-hmm. and looked at moving,
yes.
going through, trying to
right.
pass the test. And I took it 2 or 3 or 4 more times, but the Navy never did pass it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was teaching ASTP and Naval V-12 and some Marines at Tech. One time I was teaching 6 different courses one quarter, and I had never taught 5 of them before.
Mm-hmm.
So you did whatever they
yeah.
they wanted you to do.
Well, so then tell me how it happened that you were in Madison and had an opportunity to go to Chicago to a closing session of the Rosenwald.
Well, I got the Rosenwald Fellowship after I had moved from Tech to Emory after the war, right at the end of the war, and I applied to the to the Rosenwald Fund again for one of those fellowships. And there was a man who had been at Emory, whom I vaguely knew at Emory, who was at that time administering the, I believe Embry had been the administrator of the fund. And he had turned it over to this man, I'll think of his name in a minute, William Converse Haygood was his mm-hmm. name, was the secretary for the fellowship.
Yeah.
And I applied, as I say, I knew Haygood vaguely. Now that may have been a reason why I got one. And I got one. And the last ones that they gave, I don't know how many they gave each year, maybe 25 or 30 or something.
They were good for 3 years?
They were good for 1 year.
Just 1 year?
They carried about $2,500, and I was making at Emory about $5,000. So they gave me half my salary, and with this half, I had the best academic year of my life, because I didn't have to work as writing right. papers and then like that I'd done in the other graduate years.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I was invited to this party, it's not a funeral, I mean it was a celebration of the closing of the Rosenwald Fund,
mm-hmm.
and they had planned to have it at the, think of the name of the hotel in a minute, famous old hotel.
Palmer House in Chicago.
No, it wasn't the Palmer House. Another great big one, bigger than the Palmer House. Mm-hmm. And they invited all these fellows who had been given away scholarships to for many years. And somewhere I had the book, and I don't think I have it because I loaned it to somebody and never got returned, which tells the story of the Rosenwald Fellowships, and it has a roster in the back of all the people who ever had them. I think Van Woodward may have been
one of them.
Mm-hmm. And McGill was one of them. Yeah. And it's, I've always thought, and I can't demonstrate it, that that was one of the turning points in his career.
Mm-hmm.
I think he went to Scandinavian countries and was very much impressed by what he saw there.
Yeah. So you went from Madison down to Chicago for this event.
Drove down there with Tom McCormick, who was the chairman of the sociology department at Wisconsin, a native of Alabama, who had risen to that eminent job in Yankee land, an awfully nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And with my first wife, Wally, I guess we left the children. We had only one child at that time. I don't know who was
this
famous.
Would have been in the summer or the
no,
in the fall?
I remember the time of year? I think it was in the fall. If it was in the fall.
In about 47 or 8.
Well, I went in January of 48, so it would have been in the fall of 48, I believe, or it could have been in the spring of 48, but it was in the year of 48, because I came home after a year.
Yeah. Tell me what you remember about that occasion.
Well, I remember they had a panel of two people on it whose names I remember, Dr. Johnson from Fisk, Charles Johnson, and Gunnar Myrdal. And I think there was a third party on the panel. I can't remember who that was. And that was exciting just to have those two guys who represented two enormously important names in the study of Southern studies on a program together. And incidentally, going back just a minute to Arthur Raper had helped on Myrdal's book.
Yeah.
And I think his name is in the front of it somewhere.
Had he also been a Rosenwald?
I don't think so. I don't think so, but I don't remember that. Then they had a cocktail party. I never had been to many big cocktail parties in my life. And then they had this dinner, and then they had all these performances.
Charles Johnson take part in the proceedings?
Well, he was on the panel, that afternoon. Mm-hmm. That was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 3:30 or something. Mm-hmm. So the party went from mid-afternoon on to midnight or some such thing. We had to drive back to Madison. We didn't spend the night.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a couple of hours from Madison.
Yeah.
But I can't remember much about the dialogue that went on.
That would have been sometime in 48, probably.
It was in 48, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was also the year that Henry Wallace ran and the year that Strom Thurmond ran for president.
Yeah.
And the year that Truman, to everybody's surprise, won election.
Now, John helped me figure out how it was that I went to that Madison Square Garden rally for Wallace. And it would have to have been
that same summer, 48.
But it wasn't that summer. That's what's confusing to me. Wally was hospitalized. We were married in 43, and she was hospitalized beginning in 44 at Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, and was there about a year. So that would have been 44 to 45. And then she transferred to New York because her therapist there went to New York, and she was in a small hospital up the Hudson from New York City, and I had gone up there to see her. And that would have to have been 45 or maybe 46.
Well, it's possible that Henry Wallace was the vice president up until 44. He was Roosevelt's vice president in 1940.
Well, he must have been None in 40, in 45, then it must have been 45 when it was. No, I think it was in 44. And I remember that Pepper was on the program, and I told you about how they abused Monroe, Walton County, because of those four murders.
That was in 46, man. That's when that happened.
Well, in the 46, because that was gone over thoroughly.
But Henry Wallace wasn't running for anything in 46.
Well, I see. I guess it was then, maybe, that it was later then, because Wally did go back to a summer program at Columbia so that she could see her therapist, and that must have been the summer it was then, that I was up there in connection with that program.
It would have to have been 48.
Yeah, must have been. And
did you have any other contact with Charles S. Johnson other than that occasion?
Not that I can remember, but I must have been in the room with him a good many, several times.
He was the chairman of the executive committee of SRC for about 5 or 6 years.
I think he may have signed the charter with McGill and two or three others.
He did. And he presided over the meetings, and I just wondered if you remembered going to any.
I don't. I wasn't on the executive committee, although I was a founding member of it. And the executive committee meetings that I remember were with the president of Atlanta University. What was his name?
Rufus Clemmer.
Rufus Clemmer. And that was several years later. And I was at a meeting there. You know, the meeting that both Fleming and I wrote about when the first time we went in a room with Popham?
Yeah.
That was one of Mrs. Tilly's meeting of church women from Georgia, and she had invited Ms. Roosevelt to speak, and Ms. Roosevelt was there, and Ms. Tilly had asked me to be the presiding officer. She thought I was
That had to have been around 19...
Maybe so, yeah. And I had the pleasure of sitting there.
No, it was earlier than that. It might have been 47 or 8.
Had a box lunch, and they served it to us at the platform, out on the platform, sitting next to Ms. Roosevelt, and got to chat with her during the luncheon.
Remember anything she said?
I can't remember a damn thing.
And one other story I wanted you to tell me again. You recalled for me one time taking Lillian Smith to catch a plane to go to New York.
Yeah, I had gotten to know Lillian Smith because the man that was sort of my mentor at Tech was Glenn Rainey, who'd been teaching. He's the fellow that was the friend of the historian.
Yeah.
That you've seen.
Right.
And Glenn was a little less than 5 years older than I was. And he'd been teaching at Tech for several years when I came there. But I fell in behind him very fast. And he was, I had had enough indoctrination with radicalism, I guess you might say, or with a different point of view about things. At Emory, and during my years at Emory, I'd had some good teachers. And so it was easy for me to identify with the sort of things that Glenn was concerned with.
Sure.
And it was through Glenn that I met her. And I had been up to see her several times before Scott Cutlett was here in Georgia being trained at Columbus. And his girl came down to see him. And she had a friend of hers with her, and I took Scott and the two girls up to Clayton to see Lillian Smith, as I recall it. So I had seen something of her in Clayton from time to time and in Atlanta. And I had been married in 1943, and this was in February of 1944 that Lillian came to town to go to New York, because that was the publication day of Strange Fruit. Mm-hmm. And Wally and I took her to the airport, I remember, and none of us dreaming, you know, that she was going to be the author of a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And then later on, after the book had been a bestseller, she thought it ought to be turned into a Broadway play, and I've told you that story, I think. And she got her sister, who's now living up in Clayton, and who Steve Suits had a letter from about a year ago, in which he read to me. Mm-hmm. She must be about older than I am. She turned it over to her sister, who was teaching in a small junior college, but was teaching theater or dramatic arts. Mm-hmm. She thought she could translate the novel into a play. That was obviously turned out a very bad choice. Mm-hmm. Because Lillian then thought that the play would be a success like the book had been, and she wanted her friends to benefit from mm-hmm. it. So she offered Glenn and me and others, I'm sure, a chance to buy into it as co-producers. And I didn't, while it had a lot of hospital costs, doctor's costs, and I had gotten back some money from Blue Shield Blue Cross or something, and I had a little money in the bank, and you had to have $500 to have a one-half of 1% interest in it. Glenn had $1,000, and he had a 1% interest. And I put up my money, and he put up his money. Lillian was just sure we were all going to get rich. Well,
but
of course,
you lost your money.
Lost our money. Closed down after about 4 weeks. And I saw Lillian from time to time. I guess I told you the story about Glenn and I rescuing an edition of her little magazine once.
I don't remember.
Well, see, she started a little magazine called Pseudopodia, which was about as big as, I guess it had 16 pages or maybe 32, double fold, just a little magazine, 5x7. And she did a little writing in it, and some others did some writings in it. And then she made it a little bit larger, about the size of Reader's Digest, but not as many pages, but it was still.
And changed the name of it, too.
Yeah, either to South Today or Today's South. I can't remember. It's just the opposite of the Southern Regional Council later publication. Mm-hmm. And she had a piece in it that so offended one of the printers who printed the magazine that he thought it was communist stuff, and that he informed mm-hmm. the Attorney General of the state about it. So we were told, Glenn was told, Glenn picked that up, and Glenn got the impression that the Attorney General, she had the magazine printed in one print shop, and then there was another shop here that specialized in mailings, and that the magazine was taken from one shop to the other, and it was at the mailing shop, and Glenn heard it, the Attorney General might confiscate it. So we went down in my car. Glenn didn't have a car at the time. I had an old Chevrolet. And we told the people that Miss Smith had decided to distribute it from Clayton, that issue, and mm-hmm. and they let us have it. And we loaded it into the back of the car and took it to my house and put it in an old trunk we had in the basement and kept it there till I could talk to Lillian, and I shipped it on the train mm-hmm. up to Clayton, and she distributed it from there.
What do you remember about her personally? You knew her reasonably well over a period of time.
If she had been at our dinner table tonight, she would have been talking the way we were talking about mm-hmm. the war.
Yeah.
Because she was very much opposed to the war at the time it broke out in this country.
Did you think of her as an easy person to get along with?
Yeah.
Was she friendly?
And
warm?
And she had an amazingly deep psychological insights. Mm-hmm. And she told me once that Carl Menninger's book, Man Against Himself, had saved her life, that she'd been so depressed at one time and had read the book at that time, and that she'd gained insights that had saved her from possible suicide. And it was because of what she told me about Menninger. And Menninger had been down here to Georgia to see her. She'd had a little seminar of some sort up there at the camp. You see, she had facilities right. where she could sleep a number of people. And he had been there. I had not been invited to that, but I'd heard her talk so much about Menninger, and my wife obviously needed some help. And I sent her to the Menninger Clinic mm-hmm. because of what I'd learned about it. But she ran this camp, you see, for a long time
right.
On the land that her father had bought. She was born in Florida, mm-hmm. and the book, Strange Fruit, as you may recall, was set in Florida. Mm-hmm. But her father bought up a lot of land to cut the timber on it, and she used some of that land. I don't know whether her father or mother had started the camp before, but she mm-hmm. certainly was running
yeah,
it from
she,
the first
she ran it.
From the first time I knew her.
Mm-hmm.
And she had so much psychological insight that the Atlanta parents, ones who middle class who could afford to send their girls there, were delighted because they, I don't know what ages, but say at the age of 12 or 13, right. that they got a lot of stuff that was mm-hmm. opening up their eyes. I remember one simple illustration was that she had the little girls in a big egg that they had made
uh-huh.
and a little door to it. And then she would right. have them run out and run a little way and then come back to the mm-hmm. egg and then run a little further. And things that parents thought were insightful experiences mm-hmm. for their children, and they liked to send them to the yeah. Laurel Falls camp. I think it was called the Laurel Falls
Even
camp.
Even though she was fairly notorious in her public life, wasn't she?
Yeah, increasingly so, but of course in the camp days, she hadn't gotten that notorious. And as she became notorious, she closed the camp down because she was involved in writing. And I think for a while she had an apartment in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she worked up there quite a lot.
And she wrote a lot of stuff besides books, and she wrote articles.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote, as you know, about, I don't know,
a lot
maybe four or five things. Books.
Well, that's all part of what I wanted to ask you about. I had perhaps some other names of people I wanted to see if you knew, but that's the main ground. Then this supplements, as you know, an earlier conversation that we had, which was more on some personal things. Oh, I know one other thing I need to ask you. As you think back on the period of time around 1950,
uh-huh.
The whole anti-communist hysteria had really begun to sweep the country by then.
Yeah.
McCarthyism and all that. And I come away with a strong impression that some of the southern feudal lords of that time, the Bilbos and Talmadges and Thurmans and Eastlands and Walter George and what was the other senator from Georgia? Who was senator for a long, long time up there.
I wrote a letter to Walter George. It must have been in the summer of 44 or 45, and I was so disgusted with it. And I had read the papers carefully enough where I could talk about a half dozen things in which I thought he was on the wrong
mm-hmm.
side. And I
yeah.
think the letter was typed and maybe mounted to two or three pages. And I know when it was. It was before the November of 1944, because I wrote it when I was still at Tech. Outraged at this man
mm-hmm.
posing as a Democrat and so widely respected and so widely honored was on the wrong side as far as I was concerned of nearly everything.
That was true of all of those people though.
And
every state.
I went
South.
To Emory, and one of the jobs I had to do when I first went there was to edit the alumni magazine. And George, I hated his guts so that I wrote a piece about him, a short piece about him. He'd gotten an honorary degree somewhere or something, and I'd said somebody damn well didn't deserve it or something.
Yeah.
And it got me in the only hot water I ever got into at Emory mm-hmm. about that year that I spent editing that magazine.
And they came after you then?
Well, no,
Some of these people.
The deans came after me,
yeah.
the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, who was an advisor to the magazine or something. And I had to take the story out.
Yeah. Well, did you have the feeling that somebody was pushing them to do that?
No.
Or is that just the way it was in those days?
Just the way it was, I think. But I was a sister to the president. The president didn't say anything to me.
Yeah. About.
But I remember going to a meeting of church women as a speaker, and I talked about the need for socialized medicine, among other things. And I was run down by the Georgia Medical Society, and they sent one of their officers to see me about that speech I'd made about socialized medicine. And of course, I had run that radio program at Tech, which is modeled on the Chicago Roundtable.
Right.
And I had the kind of programs I was interested in. I had people like McGill on it from time to time. Glenn Rainey was on it many times. And I think I told you that I talked to Ellis Arnold about it that day we were out there, that President Britton called me in one day and said, "Mr. Griffin, we're having some complaints about your radio program you're running. Mm-hmm. We have to do something about it." And that was after Ellis Arnold had gotten elected. And that's when I said, "Dr. Britton, if you think that Ellis Arnold is going to let you fire me for the way I run that radio program, when he's just gotten elected on a similar issue that helped to put him in the governor's chair, I believe you've got another thought coming."
But he did, though.
Never did. Never said another thing to me. And I went right on doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
The only time I ever talked back to a college president like that and got away with it.
Yeah.
But that was, I think I was one of the neighborhood newspapers called Glenn Rainey and Me. I think we were called two communists that this community could well afford to see sent to the front lines or something.
Well, I started to ask you a minute ago.